Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Lahav Harkov, senior contributing editor and diplomatic correspondent, and I'm here with Yaakov Katz, editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post. What's been a difficult few weeks for our Jewish brothers and sisters in the diaspora. Our guests today are going to be focused on that issue. There's been a huge spike in anti-Semitic incidents and attacks, and mostly in the Western world.
All over, it seems, the Western world, primarily the U.S., coast to coast, also in Great Britain, the U.K. We had even a story about Ireland. I mean, wherever you're looking these days, it seems that there's anti-Semitism, and it's coming as in wake of the Gaza operation, right, that has sparked off. We've seen this before during Israeli military operations in Gaza, that there is a spike in anti-Semitism, but now it seems that it's reaching a new height to an extent.
Yeah, I do think it's reaching a new height. I think it's also reached the sort of quote-unquote influencers in the way that it hadn't in the past. You know, people might think like, oh, who cares what celebrities think about Israel and the Palestinians, but the Hadid sisters, for example, who are supermodel sisters.
But aren't they Palestinian or Egyptian or something? Right, yeah. Okay.
But like they...
So why should we be surprised by that? I don't understand that whole, you know, people get obsessed with these celebrities. Or Mark Ruffalo, he plays Bruce Banner, right? Yeah. He's the whole
Yeah, but he's super anti-Israel. He is a very good Hulk, but
I can't watch Avengers anymore now. Is that it?
No, I watch all the Avengers.
Yeah, my kid, my 8-year-old,
like Braveheart,
woke up with Hulk next to him.
So yeah, that's an issue for another day. Do we still watch the movies with anti-Semites in them? But I do think that it's important to pay attention, just because, like, just to give the example of the Hadid sisters, Bella and Gigi Hadid, like, they have more followers on Instagram than there are people in the state of Israel by far. A lot of people are seeing this, and it's especially Bella Hadid, I guess one sister's more interested than the other, who basically saying that we're committing genocide and we're an apartheid state and we're killing babies.
Okay.
And that's important on the world opinion scale. So I think
I get it. No, I get that it's important. I get that it's influential. I get that it does something. We have to do a better job at explaining what we're doing, right? I mean,
definitely.
Bella Hadid, does that spark and incite anti-Semitism, do you think?
I think that if people who are seeing, you know,
anti-Semitic acts, not thoughtness, I'm saying like someone attacking a Jew.
Right. I think that it just like sets the stage, you know, like I think that it legitimizes, because like in the Western world today, like one of the worst things you could call a person is a racist. And people are just saying, what they're saying in all these things is that Israel is an inherently racist entity. And the other thing that they like to say is that we kill children. So those are kind of the worst things you can be, right? A person who kills children and a racist. And so I just think that it creates this atmosphere of that it's not... That's not called criticizing Israel's policies, right? People are like, it's not anti-Semitic to criticize Israel. That's not criticizing Israel.
No, that's crossing a line, of course, right?
And so I
that's demonizing. That's the 3D test, right? That Nathan Sharansky,
demonization, double standard, and delegitimization.
Every Israeli says those over in his head or her head at night before going to sleep. Right?
Well, the funny thing is, right? It's like not every Israeli. It's Israelis in the circles that like we're in, where we talk to all these people who are involved in,
which is, by the way, it's interesting. It's not just foreign affairs. It's also your average Israeli. So they've heard of BDS, like this, like you know, boogeyman BDS, which hasn't really done anything to the Israeli economy or your average Israeli. They know that anti-Semitism exists. But if you're just an average person here, you're not thinking about that, right? It's not something that's necessarily on your mind. I don't know that another Israeli paper would be dedicating an entire podcast to the issue of anti-Semitism. It's just not the most important issue for them right now. They're much going to be more focused right now on the coalition talks, right, which are still ongoing, which we don't know what's going to happen with that.
Yeah, and I do think that it's unfortunate. I mean, there's very few papers now that have sort of diaspora affairs reporters, where once upon a time, diaspora and Aliyah was like a really important beat in Israeli newspapers.
And we're going to hear from our diaspora affairs reporter, Jeremy Sharon, later, who will kind of give us the overview and talk about where that anti-Semitism is coming from recently, and how it, you know, sometimes comes out on the left, sometimes comes out on the right, but where we're seeing it, the general picture around the world right now.
Yeah. But to get back to what we were saying, like, I do think it's unfortunate that Israelis, there's just not enough awareness here of what Jews in the diaspora go through. And I guess the reason is that they feel like they're safe here. So like, whatever. But I still think that it's important and they should care.
Well, you know, we talk with Mary Van Der Zyl, the head of the Board of Deputies in the United Kingdom. And one of the questions that I asked her, which I'm curious to hear what you say now that we're not on the phone, we're not talking to her, was that, and it's something that's been on my mind with the rise in anti-Semitism, is should the Israeli government take into consideration that it's going to be bombing homes in Gaza or whatever it might be bombing, obviously homes that belong to Hamas, not just private homes, and targets and legitimate military targets, but whatever it's doing in Gaza, how that is going to impact Jewish communities around the world, that there will be an uptick in anti-Semitism. Should that even, I'm not saying that we shouldn't defend ourselves because of that, but should someone maybe just raise their hand around the table when they're deciding on these operations, say, hey, just want to bring to your attention, the longer this goes on, this will affect Jews in London, New York, LA, etc.
I don't think that like it needs to affect the army's plans. I think that it would be good if all of these different government institutions that we have that are supposed to do outreach are sort of clued into what's going on here and are able to offer help in whatever way they can, whether it's the Mossad, which does provide some level of security, the Diaspora Affairs Ministry, the Strategic Affairs Ministry, which was supposed to combat delegitimization of Israel,
the Foreign Ministry, the Aliyah Ministry.
Maybe the Aliyah Ministry.
Well, they talk to Jews. They're just trying to get them to move here.
Right.
The Jewish Agency.
Yeah. So I do think that all these institutions maybe should be having some sort of strategic World Zionist Organization. Meeting when these things happen.
There's a lot more of those. They should be somehow involved in some way or another.
Right. But I don't think they should be involved in that, like, they should have a say in what the army does.
No, I don't think they need to attack this or attack that.
Right. I just think that they should get some sort of heads up so that they can plan and help people, and they should be coming up with their kinds of plans that, you know, the various kinds of plans they can,
or just have them in place for, you know, when things are going to happen that you're able to activate as needed. So Lahav, we're talking on Tuesday afternoon in Jerusalem. You are here in Jerusalem and not in Tel Aviv because you're going to meet with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who has made his maiden trip to the Middle East this week.
We tried to get him on the podcast.
We tried, yeah. Well, some people still won't come on the podcast. It's their loss. But Blinken made his first trip here. He already met with Prime Minister Netanyahu, made some nice comments about Israel's right to act in self-defense, spoke about the despicable anti-Semitism also. That was the headline that we had on our website for a big part of the day. And you're going to be hearing from him later in a briefing. So just kind of give us what's the expectation that's going to come out of this Blinken visit here right now? Or is there not really that much?
Well, the focus of the visit is the ceasefire that happened, just 5 days before we're recording this. I guess it'll be a week before the podcast comes out. And what Blinken himself and other officials in the State Department have repeatedly said is that the goal is to make sure that the ceasefire sticks. The secondary goal, I would say, is to start working on the reconstruction of Gaza.
And the mechanism, and how that will happen.
The mechanism to figure out how to do it without getting resources to Hamas.
Right, because if you just give them cement, they'll just rebuild the underground terror tunnel network that they have.
Right. So in the past, there was this mechanism that was between the U.S., Israel, the U.N., and other partners that were working with the U.N., and basically the materials went to specific construction projects and weren't just sent into Gaza. That being said, we know that Hamas was able to build tunnels and new weapons over the past 7 years, so it's clearly not perfect. And, you know, Defense Minister Gantz himself said this week that, you know, they know some percentage of the materials that get into Gaza is going to go to Hamas. So I personally am very skeptical about how this is going to work. You know, there needs to be some sort of real core solution change, you know, that in order to not have all this humanitarian aid go to Hamas.
Well, they're the ruler of Gaza. Right. You know, it's going to be a little hard to let in truckloads of cement and think that they're not going to take what they want for themselves, right? I mean, Israel doesn't have a presence there. The Palestinian Authority doesn't really have a presence there.
Right. What's interesting is that the EU is also skeptical. Last week, there was a Foreign Affairs Council meeting of the EU, and there were multiple foreign ministers that complained that said that we're constantly donating to Gaza, and then another war happens, and then we have to donate all over again, and we're sick of it.
I guess they're upset it's not such a good investment.
Exactly. And so it will be interesting to see what the Europeans do. I'll be very surprised if they stop donating, but they might try to come up with some sort of mechanism on their own going forward.
In general, my feeling is also we need to rethink the whole paradigm with the Gaza Strip. We've been, since we pulled out of Gaza in 2005 as a country, in the last 16 years, we've had six large-scale operations, one on average every 2.5 years. It's like, you know, and you talk to military officers now after this operation, and they're like, yeah, hopefully we'll get 4 years of quiet, 5 years of quiet would be great. And And it's like, so basically we did this so we can just get a few years of quiet till the next operation, right? Like, why are we not thinking, how can we strategically change this reality? And we might not be able to, but is it not worth exploring that possibility?
I hope that they're exploring it in their meetings from time to time. But on the other hand, like, Israelis don't have the stomach or the desire to do what it takes to get Hamas out permanently, because that would take, you know, a land invasion, and it would probably take a continued presence of IDF soldiers in Gaza. And I don't think anyone in Israel wants that. Well, a tiny group of people.
I think that's one option. I think another option is to go in and throw a ton of money into Gaza, build assets, build up industrial zones, desalination plants, power plants, factories, etc. And then a port, whatever it might be, off the coast in Cyprus, whatever it is. And then they have assets to potentially lose, right? So there's a gamut here that there's a spectrum. And at the moment, at least for the last 16 years, I think we haven't really done that much of either. We didn't really go in all the way and say we're taking them down completely, even though some prime ministers have promised that over the years. And we haven't done the full on humanitarian option either, because that also isn't politically, you know, popular, let's say, within Israel.
And also you need Hamas's cooperation for that.
For sure.
And it doesn't serve their agenda.
Yeah, I mean, their agenda is pretty just focused on genocide of Jewish Jews.
Right. They're all about the death and the destruction.
So speaking about death and destruction, because that's what our show's about this week. So we have a jam-packed show focused on death, destruction, and mostly anti-Semitism. We're going to be talking with Jeremy Sharon, the Jerusalem Post diaspora correspondent, who's going to, like I said, give us the overview of what's happening around the world. We speak with Mary Van Derzel, who is the head of the Board of Deputies in the UK. And we will also be speaking with Jonathan Greenblatt, who is the executive director of the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, in the United States, to get a read of what's happening in the U.S. Lots of talk, lots of anti-Semitism, unfortunately. Here we go.
So it's great to be joined by Jonathan Greenblatt, the CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL. And Jonathan, if you could just give us, you know, we're watching here from Israel, we're seeing a lot of an uptick, as you've been reporting, on anti-Semitism. Give us just maybe the broad view of where things stand and what you're seeing on the ground in the U.S. right now.
Sure. Well, first of all, it's a pleasure to be with you, Yaakov, on the Jerusalem Post podcast. So thank you for having me. You know, the ADL has been tracking anti-Semitic incidents in the United States for over 40 years. We have sort of a retail operation with more than 25 offices across the country. So we get reports through our offices, through our online form. We track things in the media. Everything that we report, Yaakov, we investigate and verify, right? So our data is very solid. And in the past, you know, when there have been conflagrations in the Middle East, you know, Israel and Lebanon, or an incident with the Palestinians, we sometimes see an uptick in anti-Semitism. But what we've seen in just the past 2 weeks has been dangerous and drastic. It's been more of a surge than anything else. I mean, our preliminary data shows there was a 63% increase in anti-Semitic incidents in the U.S. in the 2 weeks since the conflict began compared to the 2 weeks before. A 63%+ wow. increase. That's acts of harassment, vandalism, and violence directed at Jewish
people. Now, how does that compare? How does that compare if you look at like 2014?
Oh,
when there was that Gaza more, war.
I don't have the data right in front of me, but much more meager, much more meager. Mm-hmm. And frankly, keep in mind, Yaakov, that we've seen a spike in anti-Semitic incidents here in the United States over the last 5 years that are putting us now at a level that we've never seen before. I mean, the number was decreasing, if you will, since 2001, when we reached a high point around 9/11, because people said, you know, the Mossad took down the World Trade Center and other ridiculous things. So right. The number had been decreasing since 2001 until 2016, when it spiked 34%. In 2017, the number increased year over year, 57%. That was the highest single year jump we'd ever tracked. In 2018, we had a very large total, but it was down 5% over the prior year. But Yaakov, in 2018, we had the most violent anti-Semitic attack in American history, the shooting at Tree of Life. And then in 2019, we had 2,100 plus incidents it was the highest total we've ever recorded in more than 40 years. So you had a high point then. In 2020, we fully expected the number would decrease because everyone was socially distancing and telecommuting and campuses were closed and businesses were closed and workplaces were shuttered. In fact, despite all of that, in 2020, we had the third highest total in American history. So it feels like we've reached a new normal where anti-Semitism has been normalized and extremism has been excused. And it's ugly and Jews are getting caught in the middle. There's no question about it. But, you know, so, I guess the one thing I would also say, if I might, Yaakov, what's different about this time is number one, the breadth of these attacks. Like we had in just 2 weeks, it was like a wildfire from California to Arizona to Nevada to Illinois to Michigan to Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, Florida, South Carolina. Like it spread like wildfire. That was first, the breadth. Number two, Yaakov, the brutality of these attacks. And I think many have seen the videos of men driving through, you know, a Jewish neighborhood in Los Angeles and screaming, you know, Intifada and Allahu Akbar, and then assaulting diners who were eating nearby. And when doing so, asking, are you Jewish? Are you Jewish? Who's Jewish? Right. Before they started beating them up, the attacks in New York City in broad daylight, people getting pummeled and left bloodied and battered on the street. So that's really different. The sheer audacity, in addition to the span of it. And then thirdly, Yaakov, social media has amplified this in the worst possible ways.
You spoke about this massive uptick. Why is it that way? Is it because of what we had in the past? Is it because of what led to this just general increase over in recent years?
Well, I think there are a few things. I think number one, I think that social media has allowed for the spread of conspiracy theories and unhinged ideas in ways that we haven't seen in the past. Again, social media existed in 2014, but its ubiquity today as the number one news source for young people, let's say, is unprecedented. And so right there, you have this, you know, the platform from which young people are getting their information, and it's full of mischaracterizations and untruths. So I think that's first part of the problem, the context. And secondly, I think the politics are changing. And right now, there's a segment, like a pro-Palestinian segment, which feels empowered. And you see it when people are, again, like driving through Jewish neighborhoods from London to Los Angeles, screaming about raping Jewish wives and daughters, yelling, you know, free Palestine. Like, and, you know, as the politics have changed and now it's become pedestrian to compare, you know, Israel to Nazi Germany, to make crazy claims that Israel's committing slaughtering children and all these other ugly aspersions, that feeds the mania that, well, if the Jewish state is evil, so all Jewish people are evil and the Zionists must be killed. And so I think that's part of what we're also kind of wrestling with. And it's scary how these ideas have penetrated so much of the left.
So, I mean, if we're talking about how they've penetrated so much of the left, some of the people who are promoting these ideas, not calling to beat people up on the streets, but that Israel is sort of uniquely evil, are members of Congress from the Democratic Party. I mean, the ADL put out a list of ways Israel's been demonized in recent weeks. And tweets by AOC, for example, fit two out of the four categories. And I'm wondering why the ADL's voice hasn't been heard on some of these members of Congress who have been calling Israel an apartheid state, who have claimed that Israel has raided Al-Aqsa, who, you know, have also said that Israel is killing too many children, implying that it's intentional.
We've been speaking out pretty regularly, calling out individuals and examples of these crazy, the things I'm talking about right now. We've actually
been saying members of Congress lately?
I have to go back and look at individual members of Congress, Lahav. And there's always more that we can do. I'll acknowledge that we probably don't do enough. We try to call out. Sometimes we call out people in public. Sometimes we call out people in private. But we certainly haven't hesitated. And again, like we've been doing reporting and giving specific examples of where, why it's wrong to call Israel an apartheid state, or why it's wrong to suggest that Israel is committing genocide. We've been trying to expose those. And, you know, again, I'll acknowledge there's probably more that we can do, but I think we're doing it. And we're using.
How do you draw the line? Like, if someone says, calls you up and says, you know, Mr. Greenblatt, explain to me where the difference is, or where that line is between legitimate criticism of Israel and illegitimate criticism of Israel, where it crosses that line where it becomes anti-Semitism. How would you explain that to someone, like a college student or a member of Congress for that matter?
I mean, I think sometimes I refer back, Yaakov, to, you know, Natan Sharansky's three D's, right? Demonization, delegitimization, and I'm forgetting the other one off the top of my head.
Double standards.
Yeah. So I will use that with some degree of frequency. But basically, you can have very heated conversations about policies in the Middle East. Like, you can have heated conversations about policies in East Asia, let's say China, or which is a good example of a country where it has many policies with which Americans and me personally strongly disagree. Yet at the same time, where it crosses the line for us is when you demonize Israel and, you know, single it out in ways that are slanderous and clearly not constructive. When you hold it to double standards that you don't hold China or other countries to, and when you delegitimize it. And the delegitimization is particularly important, maybe the most important piece, because let's be honest. The fact is that the country has faced existential threats since it was founded, from the war of independence to the threat of Iran today, you know, surrounding it with a Shia crescent that seeks to, you know, literally destroy the country. And, you know, from Khomeini to Khamenei, you know, the supreme leaders and their acolytes have been very clear-eyed about this since the beginning, since the Islamic Revolution. So existentialism is not some, you know, philosophical discourse in a college seminar. For Israelis, it's life, it's every single day. So when you delegitimize the country, you create the basis for the kind of genocide that the Islamic Republic wants to perpetrate on the country. And so it's very, very damaging. So what do I say to people? Again, I say, have heated conversations about policies without delegitimizing the country, demonizing its people, or holding it to double standards. And then they say to me, I'm often here, well, give me an example. Like, because all I hear is when I criticize Israel, you tell me I'm anti-Semitic. And I say, if you want an example of an organization that will criticize Israel and not do it in anti-Semitic ways, I recommend you go to the website www.adl.org, because we criticize policies, you know, all the time. And I don't think anyone would characterize us as doing it in a way that's anti-Semitic.
The anti-Semitism that we're seeing now around the Gaza operation is coming from, it seems to me, from the far left, right? Some of the congressmen that Lahav mentioned, and a lot of the talk of Israel's genocide, alleged genocide in Gaza, coming from Palestinians and Arabs. This isn't the right-wing, far-right anti-Semitism that you, the ADL, had been reporting a lot about during the Trump administration. So I'm curious kind of how you look at these two different sides of the prism. Lahav, I think you have something you also wanted to add on that.
Yeah, you know, with a lot of this talk in the U.S. and controversy over police brutality, there have been some progressive groups that criticize the ADL. I wouldn't call it criticize the ADL, actually. I think it's demonization of Israel with the ADL thrown in because of programs where American police officers met Israeli police officers and learned certain anti-terror tactics. And I was just wondering how you sort of countered those claims.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very good question, Lahav. So, because these claims that somehow the ADL is bringing U.S. law enforcement to train with the IDF on tactical exercises in the West Bank is absurd. There isn't a shred of truth, a scintilla of evidence to suggest that any of these things are possible. But right now, you know, Mahdi Friedman has an excellent article. I think it was in The Atlantic. And he's written about this before, like the desire of people to try to of American activists to foist like race politics in the US onto Israel is incredibly distorting and unhelpful. Like, Palestinians are not, you know, black people. Israeli Jews are not white people. Like, the conflict is complicated. The issues are dimensional and they don't lend themselves to these facile comparisons. So specifically, you know, Lahav, Like, we have called out this lie about the work that we've done with law enforcement. But again, I think there's more we still need to do. To be very honest, it's so slanderous and defamatory, and it bears no resemblance to the facts. Now, we certainly have brought American law enforcement officers to Israel to meet with members of the Israeli National Police. They do so in classrooms. They look at PowerPoint slides and they talk about shared experiences, and they visit the holy sites, Jewish and Muslim and Christian. But the idea that you're doing military training is absurd. And the idea that law enforcement exchanges is somehow unheard of is also ridiculous, because law enforcement agencies do this all the time around the world. And frankly, when we've done it with law enforcement, we've also brought them to meet like security, the PA security forces. So these kind of crazy conspiratorial claims are part and parcel of modern anti-Semitism, right? And you do see this, actually. It's interesting. So oftentimes the far right will say the Jewish people are illegitimate. The Jewish people don't belong. The Jewish people can't be trusted, are manipulating events. And then the far left says, no. The Jewish state is illegitimate. The Jewish state doesn't belong. The Jewish state is manipulating, you know, events. And so it's remarkable how you can do a word, you know, replace. But all of it to me rings very close to the anti-Semitism we've been studying at the ADL for decades. And so we try to call it out and expose it as such whenever we can.
What can be done besides for just calling out, exposing, which I'm not minimizing the value of that, that obviously is extremely important, that people should be aware of what's happening. But, you know, and the education, of course, is also important. And we saw, for example, in the administration, we saw President Biden made a pretty strong statement the other day. Vice President Harris did. Local officials have as well on a municipal and state level. But what else can be done here?
I mean, I think there are a few things. I think number one, it's critical that finally the media is paying attention to the issue. Because for a long time, Yaakov, when I say a long time, within these 2-week period, like there were no stories about this in the New York Times or the Washington Post or any of the big major US dailies or any of like the cable news stations, which are 24/7, yet somehow couldn't find the time to show any of these videos. Finally, over the last few days, they're covering it. So I think the attention is really important, number one. I think number two, you know, we've seen in recent years, again, some of this was originated from President Trump. Now it originates from politicians on the left, that when leaders don't lead, depending on how leaders lead, you know, their followers follow. And I don't mean that in a glib sort of way, but when President Trump excused right-wing extremists, they felt empowered. And when President Biden, you know, if he doesn't speak out forcefully and clearly and consistently, then, you know, extremists on the left might feel so empowered. So his tweet yesterday was really important, as was VP Harris's. And what Steny Hoyer said last week was also really important. We need more of that. And let me just say something. And Lahav, this speaks to something that you kind of asked about earlier. I've, again, been doing a bunch of broadcast interviews and called this out. Like, politicians shouldn't say, I am opposed to anti-Semitism and Islamophobia and anti-Palestinian hate. When Jewish men are being beaten up in the street for the crime of wearing a kippah, when a soccer player is pulled aside and asked, are you Jewish, by a mob wielding knives, right? When when synagogues are being vandalized, kosher restaurants being, you know, vandalized, when Jewish people are being chased as they walk out of a synagogue, like, the issue is not Islamophobia and the issue is not anti-Palestinian hate. I'm sorry. So we want people in public life to be clear-eyed and consistently and cogently call it anti-Semitism without any qualifications, without any equivocations, period, full stop. The same right. way, I will share, that they have called out in recent months anti-Black hate or anti-Asian hate. You can call it anti-Jewish hate without feeling the need to try to create a false equivalence. I'll also say something else. We also need people in public life to acknowledge their errors. So to that end, if you haven't seen it, you should check out Mark Ruffalo's tweet this morning where he apologized.
Yeah, we did. We have a story on it on the Jerusalem Post website.
It's great. Like, there's an example of someone in public life who realized that his kind of like exaggerated claims and inflammatory rhetoric like sowed the seeds and conditioned the environment for the attacks we're seeing. So not only having the courage to speak out without equivocating, but having the humility to acknowledge when you're wrong. I think that's also important too. Really important.
Do you think that the sort of uniqueness of anti-Semitism as opposed to other hatreds, it's different in the sense that Jews are a well-integrated and relatively successful minority group. Does that make it harder for you to make inroads with people, especially on the left, but not only, just because the left deals more with, I guess, class issues? But is it difficult to make inroads because of that? Like, is that a response that you get? Because I think that in a way, when people talk about anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, that's part of what they're thinking.
Yeah, I think you're right to point that out. I mean, I think that some people perceive that the American Jewish community is beyond the point of facing any oppression, right? You had this first family and the previous first family had like Jewish members in it, right? You have Jewish people in positions of authority in the cabinet, in Congress, in business, in cultural life, in civil society. You know, American
if you
Jews?
Want some, I forget the name of the Turkish newspaper, but they printed a poster with all of the people. You know, you can hang that up in your office.
Yeah, for sure, right? But I do think some people say, well, look, the Jews have succeeded. And to use like the vernacular of the activists, were quote unquote conditionally white. Now, forget the fact that, you know, my wife isn't white. My kids don't identify. I mean, my kids, you know, are interracial, quote unquote. But
and the majority of Jews in Israel are from the Middle East.
Exactly.
And a growing percentage of American Jews are Jews of color.
Exactly. So I think but to your point, Lahav, I think there is this perception that like, the Jews are fine, you know? But I think, look, we all know the three of us on this podcast, I think much of your audience, like we face threats and have faced threats over the generations. And, you know, thank God we have Israel. Thank God we have Israel. But the reality is that living in diaspora, whether it was in the Middle East or in Europe or now in North America, like, you know, our situation, unfortunately, has almost always come to an unceremonious end at some point, right? Whether it's exile or persecution or genocide. So I think we know that what we have here in America feels like the most success and acceptance that we've ever seen. You know, again, in diaspora. And yet we also know from our own history that all this too can end. So I think as Jews, we're very aware of our vulnerability, even if the outside, you know, the non-Jewish world isn't always aware. That's incumbent upon us, therefore, to keep attention on this issue and not to, you know, not to hold back. Because I think about my own grandfather, right, who was a Holocaust survivor who's from Germany, who never imagined as a young man his entire life would go up in flames and his family would be incinerated, you know, in Auschwitz. And I think about my wife and her family who are from Iran. Their entire lives, they never, I mean, they're Iranian and they trace their lineage back, or as they say, you know, to Cyrus the Great, you know, after the Babylonian exile and the destruction of the first temple. And they never imagined that they would be anywhere other than Iran. And we know how that worked out. So I just think as Jews today in America, despite all that we have and all that we've achieved, we know too well that it can all go away. And therefore, we have got to be relentless in calling attention to this and make sure that the Jewish people are protected like any other marginalized group in this country, because this too can go away if we don't fight for what we have.
Well, we definitely hope that's not the case. Jonathan, I want to thank you for joining us today. I know you've been busy, really trying to stand up and do what you can in the ADL to stop this horrific wave of anti-Semitism and violence against Jews. So thank you for that. And we here in Israel are watching, interestingly enough, it's usually the opposite, right? You know, during the Gaza campaign, everyone is looking from there over here. I think in recent days and weeks, we've been looking from Jerusalem back to New York, LA, London, and other places with a lot of concern of what's happening there. So thank you for your time.
Well, let me
just
say, like, we watched with tremendous concern and anxiety as, you know, the rockets were falling. My heart goes out to everyone in your audience who's listening in Israel. And I do think, Yaakov, what all of this really does is remind us that we are all in this together. whether you're living in London or Los Angeles or Laud. I mean, the reality is that all of us are one Jewish people, and our fates are intertwined with one another.
Jeremy, great to have you with us. So you've been covering this anti-Semitism wave and uptick across the globe, I think, to an extent. So just give us a quick rundown. Where are we seeing things? Where is it happening? What's the status right now?
So I think, as usual, the kind of hot points are in the Western cities, in the UK, in London, in Manchester, in the US, in New York, LA, in numerous cities across the US, but also we've seen in France, in Germany, and in Latin America as well. And this is something, a phenomenon we've seen in the past, after, during and after Israeli operations such as Cast Lead in 2009 and Protective Edge, Operation Protective Edge in 2014. And we've seen these kind of spikes in vitriolic anti-Zionism and morphing into anti-Semitism during those conflicts. And we've seen it again now. So obviously it was particularly intense during the war. We've seen the continuation of those protests during the last weekend, which was just after the ceasefire came into effect. And we're also seeing that, you know, given, I guess, a relative lull from an international perspective in violence in the last few years between Israel and Gaza and Israel and the Palestinians, we've seen calls to reinvigorate the struggle and identification for Palestine and for the Palestinian cause, and to galvanize support against Israel. I've been hearing these messages of this should really reinforce the battle for BDS and the general international arena against Israel.
So you're saying it seems like it's worse now than it was in 2014, and so what you're saying is sort of in the interim the activism has grown more.
I think things are perhaps even more coordinated and than they were before, and I think especially the combination of that Black Lives Matter, racial justice, and the intersectionality concepts in the US, I think, you know, that's really giving a tailwind to those so-called progressive voices in the US in particular, which see the struggle, you know, those ideological struggles in the US for racial equality, and merging that and grafting on the struggle for the Palestinians with those struggles in the US. And that gives it a great deal of energy, because there's already a great deal of energy in the US from those left-wing, progressive, circles. They've got that energy behind them, and now they're taking that energy and funneling it into the pro-Palestinian cause as well.
We're talking about Black Lives Matter and everything. It's not just the ideological issue. It's also that last summer there was rioting across the U.S. and it gave some level of legitimacy in some circles to that kind of violence to be considered part of political activism.
I think that's definitely a factor. The violence, there was obviously a great deal of violence, and we saw people attacking bystanders and, you know, people sitting down and having a coffee and having a drink. And we saw something very similar in Los Angeles the other day with when pro-Palestinians attacked people outside, Jews and others outside that restaurant in Los Angeles. So perhaps there is an influence there of what we saw last summer as well.
Jeremy, you don't need, though, intersectionality and a Gaza operation for the be anti-Semitism. We've seen a steady rise in recent years, Brian, if I'm not mistaken, in all of these different places, in the US, also in the UK. I mentioned also that incident of where that pregnant woman was beaten in some alleyway, right? Which happened before Gaza. So the anti-Semitism is out there, right? This is just the nice thing that you can pick up on and use to as an excuse. No?
Yeah, that's true to an extent. I mean, we also have to look at the different directions from which anti-Semitism is coming from. There is the right wing, far right anti-Semitism, which is prevalent in the US, in parts of Europe, and there's also the anti-Semitism from the hard and far left, which is obviously more manifest in regards to Israel-Palestinian conflicts. And part of that is also the identification with the Palestinians of Muslims in the West, such as the Pakistani and Bangladeshi population in the UK, and Arab Americans and other Muslims in the US. So it's important to distinguish between the two different background forces of anti-Semitism. I think that there's also, you have to look at the different context, because anti-Semitism began rising in, according to the ADL statistics, I think in 2016 or so, and you have to look at the context of the Trump of Donald Trump in that equation, because there was definitely a significant spike in from 2015. When he began his presidential campaign. So that has to be taken into account. And also in, for instance, in Germany on the far right, since the influx of refugees, from Syria,
but that's far right anti-Semitism, and what we've been seeing, these pro-Palestinian and then just attacking Jews. Anti-Semitism is a far left anti-Semitism.
Well, I mean, for instance, in Syria, it's not. Is it far right or is it far left? It's coming from the Muslim refugee community in Germany. So
some people might say Germany's looking like Syria. You know,
so it's important to understand where the different forms of anti-Semitism are coming from.
Well, when you said that thing started, with the rise of Trump. I just think that, like, we use it, like, I don't think Trump is an anti-Semite. Do you think Trump is an anti-Semite? Like, I feel like people blame Trump in a way that's not fair, even though I do think there's a significant portion of his supporters who...
No, but maybe in the way that he wasn't always so quick to condemn...
Trump's definitely got...
He enabled.
Problematic racial profiling.
He enabled by not saying enough and not pushing back enough. Right, that's what I think.
When David Duke endorsed him and Trump wouldn't come out and just say, I don't want this guy, I don't want his followers, I don't want them to vote for me. That kind of opened the door for people to push the lines even further.
The issue with Trump is not whether or not he's an anti-Semite himself, and he does have problematic comments he's made in the past of having Jews do your accounts and that kind of thing.
I think they do his accounts, by the way.
They're also his lawyers.
Yeah. And his lawyer.
So it was more that aspect of giving a tailwind to American first nationalism, that kind of thing, which emboldened, kind of to a certain extent, the white supremacists. So everything has to be seen within its context. Another aspect of everything is the terrible, terrible anti-Semitism which students are facing on campus in the UK and in the US. I mean, terrible stories from the UK of students who are just completely Jewish students, completely cowed on campus, facing, you know, terrible comments of, you know, Jews are doing genocide and Zionists are responsible and just fear amongst Jewish students of expressing in any way their Jewish identity or an identity with identification with the State of Israel.
Is this going to change anything for Aliyah? Do you think that we'll see maybe an increase in the number of people who will decide to move to Israel, make Aliyah to Israel?
I did a preliminary check actually this morning, but the data is not exactly in yet because, I mean, we're still in May.
Well, if you look at the past, right? Remember when after the Hyper Kasher shooting attack, what was that, 2015 in Paris?
There was tens of thousands of French Jews.
Well, there was a spike. There was a spike in French Jew in
they
French
thought
Aliyah,
it would blow up, but it very quickly
tailed off.
Yeah.
So when circumstances, especially from Jews in Western countries, when the circumstances, the intense anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, when that fades, I think the immediacy or the urgency of making Aliyah because of feeling so uncomfortable and so threatened in Western countries, I think that declines. But I would say that the Israeli government was criticized during the crisis for French Jews after the terrorist attacks. They was criticized for not coming up with a plan to really take advantage of all those. There were tens of thousands of French Jews who were interested. And only
it's a double-edged sword, right? Like when I think it was Lieberman was foreign minister at the time, and he said some things like, you know, that you all should really make Aliyah, and then it became a little bit of a diplomatic issue.
I think Bibi's also got in trouble for the same thing.
Ariel Sharon got in trouble. Yeah. Sharon got in trouble for it back in the day.
There's a difference between saying make Aliyah and then saying we'll do everything we can to make Aliyah easier and more accessible.
I was thinking about this during the Gaza operation. So if people were to make Aliyah, but there's a part of me, I'm a Zionist, of course. So I would say, yes, Israel might not be that safe all the time, right? We had a stabbing just a few blocks away from our office yesterday, right here in Jerusalem. There's rockets that 4,500 or something that flew across the country. Lahav, you in Tel Aviv were spending nights with your kids in a bomb shelter. Jeremy and I here in Jerusalem had a little better during the 11 days of the Gaza operation. But on the other hand, I say, okay, but you know, it's risky, it's dangerous, but it's in your own country. On the other hand, I also understand that people look to Israel and they still see it to be scary and more of a risk. No,
and I mean it's a lot to ask someone to just like overturn their whole lives. I mean, all of us did it at some point, but you know, it's not necessarily easy, and also lives in a lot of these countries are very comfortable in ways that often living in Israel is less so. So, again, I am very pro-Aliyah, and I think Israel should welcome all Jews with doors open, but I also am not judgmental about it.
I think one effect of the anti-Semitism, the spike in anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, or if both, we might see is further problems for Jews, young Jews in particular, and especially those who are more inclined to liberal circles to identify with the state of Israel. If such identification becomes associated with, in inverted commas, murdering children and apartheid and everything else that Israel is alleged to have done, because it builds such a kind of zeitgeist in the popular discourse that, as we've kind of said, it becomes almost upsetting, embarrassing, and problematic, and perhaps even endanger yourself by identifying with the state of Israel. And if you're already aligned with left-wing liberal thought, then you might think, well, I have less and less to do with Israel, right? if this is what Israel is alleged to be about and alleged to have done. So I think that's a big danger with that massive spike in anti-Semitism and anti-Zionist rhetoric we're seeing across the Western world. And it could affect that aspect of identity of young Jews, and that is a problem.
Unfortunately, anti-Semitism has always been around. And as long as the Jewish people are around, will likely always continue to be around, right? I don't think that since the time of the Bible, there have been forces that have tried to eradicate and kill Jews and Jewish people.
Pharaoh said we were going to gang up with Egypt's enemies, right?
He did.
So, starts there.
At least there. Okay, Jeremy, thanks for the update and for continuing to cover this extremely important story.
Welcome.
Welcome, everyone, to our favorite segment, the Tweet of the Week. I want to once again invite people to send me what they think are interesting or funny tweets over the next week at Lahav Harkov. This week's tweet is more anti-Semitism to fit with the theme of...
Well, that's the theme of the show. You got to stick with it.
Right, exactly. So we have making his debut on our podcast is the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei.
The Supreme Leader.
Exactly. He said, "You fight against oppression is a manifestation of the verse. If you aid God's cause, he will aid you and strengthen your steps. By God's power, you will be victorious." And this is the key part. "Purify the Holy Land from the contamination of the usurpers, God willing. Your brother, Sayyid Ali Khamenei."
Wait, who are the usurpers, Lahav?
You.
Oh, that's us. Oh, because I was confused who he was referring to in that tweet.
Yes. We have usurped the Holy Land, according to Khamenei, and we have contaminated it, and we need to be purified. And this tweet went up. At this point, it has been about 26 hours since the tweet went up. I can assure you that many thousands of people reported it to Twitter, and it is still there.
That's one part of the story, but the other part of the story is that he's tweeting this out right while Iran is sitting with the P5+1, right, and talking about a return to the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, And the man has no shame in sitting and talking to the Western superpowers about doing a diplomatic agreement and calling for the, how does he call it? Purify the Holy Land, basically kill Jews, right? Eradicate the land of Israel of all its Jews.
And well, you know,
no shame.
They were shamelessly supporting Hamas last week, and not just, you know, they've given Hamas lots of money in the past and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, but they were also sending all sorts of encouraging messages to the Palestinian terrorist groups in Gaza last week. And last week, the talks were actually happening. Now it's a little bit of a lull. He's tweeting in the lull between the fourth and fifth rounds of talks, which starts on the Thursday of this week. But yeah, I mean, they are talking with the U.S. to rejoin the Iran deal while they are funding the bombing of America's best ally in the Middle East, Israel.
Right. Right. And those talks were taking place while the Gaza operation was happening as well.
Right. 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 It says something about the U.S. too, but that's, we'll have to get into that another time.
That itself is a big issue. Why is Twitter not taking this down? Why do they allow? I mean, you know, I tweeted on Friday, right? And you tweeted back at me. I tweeted on Friday. Thank God there was quiet, right? The ceasefire had gone into effect. I took my kids cherry picking near Kfar Etzion, near Alon Shvut. And in the Gush Etzion area. And I tweeted out just a nice picture with some great cherries, by the way, really good cherries. I recommend it. And someone said, I hope a rocket lands on you and your kids and kills them or something like that. And you tweeted back at me, welcome to my life or something, right?
Yeah, well, during the, you know, when there was a lot of rockets on Tel Aviv, or, you know, not a lot compared to the South, but for Tel Aviv a lot, I said, you know, I tweeted, have you ever had to look for a playground for your kids based on where the nearest bomb shelter is? And I got bombarded with people being like, you know, I hope a rocket falls on your kids. It's awful.
It's awful. But why does Twitter, so they let this stuff stay. They don't take it down. Ali Khamenei calling to purify a land of people, which can only mean one thing, their genocidal destruction. How does Twitter, how does, what's his name, Jack Dorsey, how does this guy just let this stuff stay up?
So when it comes to Khamenei, the Knesset, was actually the Diaspora Affairs Committee. Sometimes people just use the Knesset committees for whatever they want.
Right, it's political talk or saber rattling or something.
So that was their excuse. A representative of Twitter in, and the Twitter representative said that it's political saber rattling. And I was like, no, this is a saber that's going to chop someone's head off. Like, this is not.
This is political saber
talking.
Right, and he's not just, he's also developing nuclear weapons. He's also trying to, he's also supplying missiles that are then fired at Israel. But two terrorist organizations. It's not just political talk.
Right. But to Twitter, it's saber rallying and rattling, and it's allowed to stay up, and it's absurd. You know, there's speech in the U.S. that's banned that is, you know, whatever, I guess it violates their terms of service, but it is not calling for genocide, you know, and so they have this double standard.
I love that. The terms of service. Does it, the anti-Semitism or genocidal talk, it would have to violate terms of service of social media companies. An important tweet that comes at an important time, and we'll go back to the show. Thanks, Lahav.
We're here with Marie van der Zyl, the president of the Board of Deputies of British Jewry. And we wanted to talk to you about what's been a crazy spike in anti-Semitism. I read a recent blog post from the Community Security Trust, the organization that does a sort of private security and gets anti-Semitism complaints from the Jewish community in the UK, that there's a five-fold increase in the past few weeks. Can you tell us what it feels like on the ground there?
On the ground, thank you for inviting me to talk to you. On the ground, it's been, to be honest, really frightening. Last week, I'm sure you've probably read, the wider British public as well as the Jewish community were absolutely horrified. Footage of a convoy of cars waving Palestinian flags, driving through Jewish communities in northwest London, swearing at Jews, calling for daughters to be raped. And the truth, unfortunately, is, although this footage was hideous, you know, a lot of us weren't surprised, because every time the conflict flares up, anti-Semitism incidents increase in the UK at an alarming rate. And if you said the CST figures speak for themselves. So this happened before in 2008. It's happened in 2014. And there have been incidents. I've had so many incidents reported to me. They include anti-Semitic graffiti, Mazzotte being vandalized, verbal and physical assault. And we know it's not just here, it's around the world, including in Germany, where mobs have been screaming abuse outside synagogues. And I've heard also in New York, Montreal, Los Angeles, there have been a number of violent assaults and incidents. And every day I am being inundated with fresh incidents, which also includes issues in classrooms where teachers are being subjected to very difficult treatment and being threatened both by pupils and trying to be threatened to also make statements against Israel. This is an unprecedented level of anti-Semitism, very, very difficult to deal with.
Marie, is this the worst it's been due to an Israeli military operation? If you think back to 2014 during Operation Protective Edge, or even further back, I don't know, the Second Lebanon War, Operation Cast Lead in Gaza in 2009, was there ever an Israeli military operation that sparked such anti-Semitism like you recently have been experiencing?
Well, I wasn't in my communal position at the time in 2014, but I do remember it was extremely difficult. And I came to Israel in 2014, on a mission from the UJIA to give support to Israel. It was very difficult, but this appears to be, I feel it does seem to be worse, even though the conflict wasn't as long as 2014, which was some 5 weeks. I think it's set off a whole torrent of anti-Semitism here. It's extremely, extremely difficult, and the whole community is impacted on this. I'm very, very frightened.
So what do you credit that change then to? So why this extreme uptick this time around? What has changed in Britain that has led to this?
Well, we've had some very difficult years in the UK. We've had to deal with the situation with Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party, where anti-Semitism has been brought from the fringes of society into the mainstream political party. We're also facing a situation in universities, which is very difficult to deal with. I suspect this has been simmering under the surface, and this is the most worrying legacy of this conflict is the underlying anti-Semitism, and we're very fortunate, can I just say, that the government of this country has been extremely supportive to the community. I've met with the Prime Minister and the Home Secretary last week. They've expressed very strong support for the Jewish community. We've certainly discussed with them the abuse of Jewish residents with the car convoy. And of course, again, we're asking for the proscription of Hamas in its entirety as a terrorist organisation. So I think that there have been some very difficult underlying issues of anti-Semitism that haven't gone away. And the conflict has just opened Pandora's box.
I saw Prime Minister Boris Johnson's comment, that said that as a country and as a society, we will not allow anti-Semitism to grow and fester. But what concrete steps do you think need to be taken? You talked about outlawing Hamas, but what do you think can be done, to help Jews locally?
In the short term, we very much want to thank the CST for all the work that they are doing to keep us safe. And unfortunately, it's necessary to have a security outside Jewish schools and synagogue. And we've asked certainly for that to be making sure that is an absolute priority. It's a very difficult situation. There's also been the impact of coronavirus, where there's been anti-Semitism, blaming Jews for the medieval Black Death, bubonic plague. That's also led to increased anti-Semitism and conspiracy theories there. If there is a culture of anti-Semitism which is very, very, very difficult to challenge. And primarily that's been at the forefront of our minds as a relation to Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party. And we have to keep working at this. As I say, we're very fortunate that we've got the support of the government, and the police have been excellent in these last few weeks, which is a very, very difficult time. There is no easy answer to tackling anti-Semitism. We are calling out any anti-Semitism. We are making sure we deal with it. We're also very concerned at the media bias against Israel that's daily being reported on the BBC. We will be sending them a report, and we're standing very much with our communal colleagues to face this current situation. But it's been very difficult and very alarming for the Jewish community, the average Jew on the street. Nobody can miss this. There is an outpouring of anti-Semitism that we have to face, but I can't give you that magic answer.
Is there, you know, I've seen these videos, and I'm sure, you know, you've definitely seen them and maybe experienced some of them, unfortunately, as well. But, you know, there was that car convoy, obviously. There was the video of a young Jewish woman, I think pregnant, right, who had
this was before
Gaza, right, but still who was beaten in that alleyway. There was the recent story of the rabbi who was beaten and attacked near London, right, in a suburb. I mean, if you're Jewish and you're outwardly visibly Jewish, are Jews scared today to walk the streets of London, of Manchester, of Leeds, or wherever it might be?
I went to see Rabbi Rafi, who you just mentioned. He was very badly beaten up. And yes, of course, he is scared. Lots of people are scared, especially Jews that look visibly Jewish. This is a whole different degree from the conflict to the situation previously. We are in absolutely different territory. The CST are very, very good at collating all incidents of anti-Semitism, and the fivefold increase is being felt by everyone, particularly as there's lots of Palestinian flags following that convoy. I think that's alarmed Jews and non-Jews, calling for Jews to be killed and daughters to be raped is a concern not just to the Jewish community, but to the whole community here in the UK. It's definitely making people think twice. My daughter goes to a Jewish school. Boys have been told there not to walk around with their kippah and to make sure they've got caps. It's very alarming for children to have to live under these circumstances. But it's not just the UK. It's around the world.
One of the things that I think Israelis don't fully appreciate or understand all the time is how their actions impact Jewish communities around the world. So, like, you know, Israel goes to a war in Gaza because of rocket fire. Of course, Israel needs to defend itself. But then you have this uptick in anti-Semitism attacks against Jews, whether it's in the UK and in the US or anywhere else. Do you, as a Jewish diaspora leader, would you want to, do you expect or would you like to see Israel taking that into consideration when it embarks in such military operations of this? Is that something that Israel should consider, do you think? Or do you understand that Israel can't necessarily consider that?
No, I understand that Israel cannot be attacked by Hamas and be subject to these terrible rocket attacks. Israel's got a right to exist and defend itself. My brother and his family live in Israel. I don't live in Israel. It's not for me to say what should be done, because that has to be up to the Israeli government. But frankly, I fully understand that they will be wanting to defend Israel against rockets from the terrorist Hamas. So there isn't an option. And we also know that this huge sympathy, you know, for all civilians that have been caught up in this conflict and the many that have lost their lives. But here in the UK, I and the Jewish community, we absolutely understand that Israel must defend itself. And we also know that Israel takes as many steps as it can to avoid any unnecessary deaths as possible. We stand with Israel. We support Israel. We had on Sunday a fantastic rally in support of Israel. I don't know if that was broadcast to you. And Ambassador Zippy Hotembeli spoke at that. And there is an outpouring of support from the community here. So we absolutely understand. There are, of course, some people that have different views. There is the vocal minority who will criticize Israel, who see things differently. But the majority of the Jewish community absolutely understand Israel's right to defend itself. And at the Board of Deputies, our official policy is to support a two-state solution, which results in a secure Israel alongside a viable Palestinian state. But as I've said, we're realistic.
I want to ask you if you feel like, first of all, it is wonderful to see Jewish communities coming out and supporting Israel. We actually had a photo of the demonstration in London on our front page this week. I wanted to ask if there's something that you think that Israel should be doing for diaspora Jews in the UK and elsewhere. Do you feel that there's good cooperation with the embassy? Do you feel that there's other things that Israel could be doing to help Jews that suffer when Israel is suffering?
Look, we can always do more. I can tell you that the embassy is extremely supportive, but right now Israel's priorities have got to be in dealing with the conflict. But once that has settled, of course, any support that we can have is always absolutely welcomed. It would be nice to be able to discuss this with ministers in Israel so they are aware that actions do have impact on the diaspora, but we also understand and have to work with what we can. But yes, of course, increased support meetings would also always be welcome.
Well, Marie, we want to thank you for joining us on the Jerusalem Post podcast, and we wish you and the rest of the British Jewish community quiet and some indefinite safety. So thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you. And we all pray for peace. And thank you for interviewing me.
Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week from a special location. Lahav and I, together with Mayan Hoffman, the head of strategy at the Jerusalem Post, will be in Dubai and we'll be recording our show from the sidelines of a Jerusalem Post conference together with our Emirati friends at the newspaper Khalij Times. So stay tuned for a really great show from the United Arab Emirates.